before the takeoff of air travel, the main means of travel was boats, and constantly arriving and leaving, and this sort of freedom and a slight distance from central government in the case of Smyrna, Alexandria and Beirut. They weren't, at that time, capital cities.
Is there something about there being ports as well, which isn't only to do with people coming and going, with different nationalities mingling, but to do with the fact that they are there for trade, and that if you want to make money, then making money becomes rather more important than worrying what religion the person you're trading with is?
Yes, you're absolutely right. And people said so at the time. And in fact, Cicero says this, where he, in a passage, he praises Rome for not being a port because he fears the allurements of easy living.
The downfall of cosmopolitan Alexandria and Smyrna come from outside. They're to do with nationalism. They're to do with other more powerful forces. If we could now look at Beirut, which is still in many ways an ongoing story, as the other two cities aren't, the description that you create of Beirut during the Civil War is really very distressing. And you talk at one point about bodies just chucked in the streets like beer cans. You even say people turned vegetarian just because they were just so sickened by the corpses all around. In this scenario, though, there were heroes, weren't there?
Yes, ordinary people carrying on with their jobs at the risk of their lives, crossing the Green Line to get to work. Ambulance drivers, taxi drivers. I mean, there are many, many accounts of this. Ordinary Lebanese, and Robert Fisk has a wonderful phrase about the toughness of ordinary Lebanese getting on with their life, who had nothing to do with the young men recruited by the militias, some of whom were recruited with drugs and, of course, money.
The militias, you've talked to some of these people.
Yes, and many of them have been morphed into nightclub security. They have the usual excuses. I did it for the good of my country.
You also give a great sense, not of, you know, people retrospectively using excuses, but of actually having found some kind of liberation in violence.
Yes, I think that's true. They were unemployed. They didn't know what to do with themselves. One chap said to me, yes, it was an alternative to drinking cigarettes. They found a purpose with these militias. There was also a bureaucratic angle. Many of them were people without proper passports or identity papers. So they were promised, oh, if you fight for us, you'll get Syrian or Lebanese identity papers.
You've visited and indeed lived in Beirut in this century, 2001 onwards for a bit. Many people say that despite everything that's happened there, despite the violence, despite the hatreds, that it is really the most exciting city in that part of the world still, that there's a sense of it being, you know, the place where everything's happening, both in terms of just hedonistic pleasure, but also in terms of culture. It's certainly meant to be the publishing centre for the Middle East and so on. I mean, do you get a sense of it as being a tragic place or really as somewhere that is utterly vibrant and alive?
Certainly, Beirut is a sort of window for many Arabs and people of the Middle East on the outside world, and they feel for Beirut. There is a sort of cult of Beirut in Arab pop music, many songs about it. So it does resonate throughout the Arab world. And the same with the recent wars of 2006, the Israeli invasion and other events. And even for Iran, Iranian leaders have said Beirut is a lung through which Iran breathes. So it is very important to these people. A city with joie de vivre, perhaps because of its vulnerability and because they are, in effect, dancing on the edge of a volcano. Lots of galleries, lots of interest in history, because they have so many rival religions. Each has its own point of view on Lebanese history. When was the Golden Age? Who is the real Lebanese? Lots of interest in politics now. And in part, it flourishes in contrast to other Middle Eastern cities where states are so powerful, censorship is so extensive, the secret police is so pervasive. People aren't frightened of the police in Beirut. They're really frightened of lack of police.
You seem to be giving a double message. One, I get the sense that they were really exciting places and in many ways very positive. But I'm also getting the impression that they can't work for some reason. Is that right? Is there a future for something like you describe in this book? a cosmopolitan city.
I think all history and all politics is ultimately military-based. It's to do with the lack of an army. These cities never had a reliable army of their own. They needed a state army or a foreign army to maintain order, because it's unlikely to get people of one religion to fire on their co-religionists, and they were so divided. But if you have an army, say a UN force or something like that, I think they can work well. Singapore works well, and it has the largest port in the world now. Shanghai has come back to being what it once was. Many cities in Europe are beginning to feel more of an independent identity, and the mayors of Europe have regular meetings now. And these are economic and cultural realities, just as much as states for some people. Brussels is its own self, independent of Flemish and Walloon Belgium. It all depends on having a good army.